All right, we're beginning on the top of Yud Zayin Amud Aleph, but the two dots. Gemara here is discussing the Shitot of Rabbi Kiva and Rabbi Yishmael. They were brought in order to explain our Mishnah, which is the Olam Shochatim, that you always have to do Shechita. Rabbi proposed the fact that it was in Shitot Rabbi Yishmael. Rabbi Yosef rejected it and said it's got to be within the Shitot of Rabbi Kiva. Now the Gemara explicates a little bit on their positions, and then we'll do it further as the Gemara progresses, which is B'maika Miflege. What is this machloket between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yishmael? Rabbi Akiva savar basar ta'ava lo itzar klal. Rabbi Akiva believes that basar chulin was never asur, as opposed to Rabbi Yishmael, who believes that in the midbar the only access they had to meat was through kodoshim. Rabbi Akiva says that chulin were also permitted in the midbar. Rabbi Yishmael savar basar nechira lo ishtare. Rabbi Yishmael says there was never a time where you could eat meat without shechita. In Rabbi Yishmael's shita, when they're in the midbar, the only thing they ate was basar kodoshim. That was the only thing that was permitted, because basar ta'ava was not allowed. They ate basar kodoshim. When they enter into Eretz Yisrael, what switches or changes to that point is the heter for basar ta'ava, the ability to eat chulin. And so then the chiddush of the psukim is the ability to use shechita by chulin. On the other hand, for Rabbi Akiva, in the Midbar, they also ate basar chulin. And so then, what's the chiddush of the psukim in Dvarim Yudbet that tell us that you're allowed to eat basar tava when you come into Eretz Yisrael? The chiddush there is not the fact that you can eat basar chulin, but rather the chiddush is that you have to do shechita. In the Midbar, there was no necessity for shechita. Once you enter into Eretz Yisrael, there's a necessity for shechita for chulin. For Kodoshim, Shechita always existed and was always a necessity. Just for Chulin, it switched from the Midbar, where Nechira was allowed, to Eretz Yisrael, where only Shechita would be allowed. Again, for Rabbi Yishmael, the Chiddush is the fact that you can eat Basar Chulin, not the fact that you have to do Shechita. Shechita was the only mechanism for being matir an animal. The only question is, can you eat Basar Chulin? And that is, in the Midbar, you could not eat Basar Chulin. On the other hand, when you entered into Eretz Yisrael, there was a heter Basar Chulin, Ayyidei Shechita. Bishlamal the Rabbi Yishmael. According to Rabbi Yishmael, Hainu Dichtiv, it explains the Pasuk v'shachat et ben abakar, that you have to do Shechita on the Korban Ola. Ela la Rabbi Akiva, my v'shachat. Why does it have to be v'shachat? He says Nechira was allowed. You don't necessarily need Shechita. Where it says, Kodoshim Shaini. This we already noted when we were explaining the Shita of Rabbi Akiva, that Rabbi Akiva believes that Kodoshim required Shechita. That's explicit by Kodoshim. So even when they were in Midbar, and Chulin was Nitar Yedei Nechira, Kodoshim still required Shechita. Vishlam Ola Rabbi Yishmael, according to Rabbi Yishmael, Hainu Dichtiv, when Moshe Rabbeinu in Parshat Balotcha says to Hashem, how can I feed all these people meat? Ha Tzon Ubakar Yishachet Lahem. I should shech all the Tzon and Bakar on their behalf. So, for Rabbi Yishmael, that would have been the only mechanism for getting them meat, would be through Shechita, because you have to do it through Kodoshim. El Rabbi Akiva, my Hatzon Abakar, Yishachet Lahem. What do you mean? Why do you have to do Shechita? If he's giving them Basar Chulin, Inacher Lahem. It should have said, I will prepare for them, I will give them meat without Shechita. Where it says, Nechira Shelahen, Zohi Shechitatan. Their Nechira for Chulin in the Midbar is the equivalent to Shechita in Eretz Yisrael. In essence, we use Shechita in two different ways. One is Shechita in the sense of the actual physical Shechita that you do to the animal. We also use Shechita in the sense that the matir, the thing that allows the animal to be eaten. And so in this case, it doesn't mean to do the physical Shechita. It means to be matir the animal to achila. And the mechanism in the midbar for that was Nechira. And that's what it means. Nechira shelahen zohi Shechita tan. Bishlama the Rabbi Yishmael, Hainu Ditznan, we have a Mishnah, Shochet, Minitavla Biyado, Suin Shechita, something goes wrong, and he makes it into a Nevela. Rashi gives you a menu of items that he could have done over here, including a Gimat Sakin, there was some sort of nick in the knife, Shihya, he delayed, he tarried in the Shechita, Darsa, he pressed with the knife. There are all sorts of things that can cause a failing in the Shechita. V'hanocher. So over here, the Mishnah uses the term nocher, which Rashi defines, and I'll come back and explain it in 1 minute. V'hame'aker, or you uproot the simanim, patur milachasot. Then you don't have to do kisui hadam. Kisuei dam is required by chayot and by ofot. That is, by the wild animals and by fowl. There's a requirement that after the shkita, that the dam be covered over, you do kisuei dam. Again, we'll get to that later on in the Masechta to discuss all the details of that. But in this case, if some reason, whatever you were doing failed, which is that you did a shkita, but you were not successful at the shkita, so it's not mutar ba'achila, or you did a nechira or an akira, both of which would then be failings in the shkita, then you don't have to do a kisui hadam, because you didn't create a kosher animal. You didn't do shkita. Ela Rabbi Akiva, amai patur min lechasot. Why, according to Rabbi Akiva, don't you have to do kisui hadam? For Rabbi Akiva in the Midbar, nechira was the shkita, and then you needed to do kisui hadam. That means if you did on a tzvi and an ayal, in the Midbar you did nechira, or any fowl, you would have to do kisui hadam. So then, when you come into Eretz Yisrael, you should have continued that practice of doing kisui hadam with nechira. Mar says, hov itzar, itzar. No. Once nechira is taken off the table, it's taken off the table completely. Doesn't mean that, oh, nechira doesn't work and you can't eat it, but you still have to do kisui hadam. No. Nechira then becomes something that is no longer associated with shechita, and so therefore, it doesn't even qualify to get you a kisui hadam. Now, to the nocher. Rashi over here defines nechira in the following manner. Shikora lo orka. He cuts it a lengthwise. Minichireha, from its nostrils, va'adachazen, until the chest. You can see here the picture of it. I'm going to be using sichat kulin, so a reference to the picture sometimes. But here you can see him. He took a slice down from the nostrils all the way down to the chest. That's how Rashi defines nechira over here. The problem with that is that Rashi, later on Chav Zayin Amud Bet, in discussing Nechira, says the following. The Ein Nevilat of Kriya Nevila, Alim Kein Meita Me'eleha, died on its own. O Haragabi Makah Shaloya De Simanim. Or you did some injurious thing to it that wasn't with the Simanim. Aval, Nechira O Ikur Simanim Kasherbo. But if you do either Nechira or Ikur Simanim, that is kasher. So Rashi over there makes it clear that ikur, like we said over here, means uprooting the simanim. Nechira is also associated with the simanim. It's not clear to me whether that also means when you move down from the nostrils, down to the chest, you're also cutting through the simanim. Here it sounds like there's some sort of stabbing through the simanim itself, or cutting of the simanim. That's not shechita, but at least you require it to be associated with the simanim. And Tosafot on Daf Chaf as well, in Divrei HaMatchil Lo Amran, says something similar. Even though you don't require shechita, you still require nechira in the simanim. Now, both of those are mentioned, number one, with regards to birds. So then it's hard to argue nechira or nocher means from the nostrils down. That's not really applicable by birds. And number two is, both cases, Rashi and the Tosafot say that Nechira is associated with the Simanim. So, Rashi's definition over here might be one form of Nechira, but it has to include at least cutting of the Simanim, which is important, and it has to apply to birds where there is no nostrils to speak of, and so that it has to have some application there as well. So it might be along the lines of more stabbing, or not a cut like Shechita, but it gets through the Simanim. In addition, I will note that the word nechira is used, just like we did with shechita, in two contexts. There might be nechira as the noun describing a particular act. Nechira could also be the more generic opposite to shechita, which is just like shechita is a way to get basar beheter, and there's also a particular act of shechita, so too nechira might be the antithesis of shechita, which is anything that is not shechita is called nechira, a general term. And there's also nechira, which is a particular type of way of killing, which clearly includes simanim, but also here, according to Rashi, includes cutting from the nostrils all the way down to the chest. How that act is particular may not be as clear, but what is clear is that nechira is differentiated from shechita. So that's just a little bit about the nechira. Now the Gemara continues. Bish l'malar abikiva damar basar tarva lo itzar klal, hainu dichtiv. Then we understand the pasuk over here that says, ach, Kasher yachelet atzvi v'atayal ken toch lenu. So there, the parshia in Perek Yud Bet that speaks about ki yachiv et gvulcha, when Hashem expands your gvulot, And then you're going to have this basar ta'ava. Over there, the psukim are speaking in a context of psulei hamukdashim. And there it says about the psulei hamukdashim, you will eat the psulei hamukdashim the same way that you eat the tzvi v'ayal. It says here, ki yarchiv elukechat gulchak, and she diber lach, and then the psukim that we discussed yesterday about v'zavachta mi barcha mitzonka. And then immediately afterwards it says, ach kasher yachelet tzvi v'tayel ken tochlenu, hatamei v'tor yachdav yochlenu. So there's an instruction in the pasuk that when you do this, the psulei hamukdashim will look like a tzvi and a yal. So now, for Rabbi Akiva in the Midbar, when Moshe is speaking to the people in the Midbar, he's saying to them, listen, your psulei hamukdashim are going to be just like a tzvi and an ayal. So for Rabbi Akiva, tzvi and ayal in the Midbar were acceptable forms of meat that they could eat. Because you had shchitat chulin, not really shchitah, but nechirah, but you had a way to eat basar chulin, and tzvi and ayal are examples of that. For Rabbi Ishmael, tzvi and ayal are chayot that don't end up on the Mizbeach. So there was no way that they could be eating tzvi and ayal in the Midbar. So that's the Gemara's question. For Rabbi Akiva, I understand the pasuk has meaning to the people in the Midbar. But, Rabbi Shmuel, tzvi v'ayal gufei mi'avishori. He's telling them, oh, the psulei hamukdashim are going to be just like the tzvi and ayal. Well, tzvi and ayal are esurim. What does it mean they're going to be just like the tzvi and ayal? The Gemara says, ki asa rachmana behema v'chazya l'akrava. So this goes back to our introduction to chulin, which is that when the Torah said that you can't eat basar chulin in the Midbar, that is only things that were applicable in Kodoshim. If you could bring it as a korban, then you couldn't eat it as basar chulin. Av chaya, the lo chazir l'chakrova, lo asar rachmano. On the other hand, a chaya that doesn't have the ability to be put on the mizbeach, therefore there is no isur min haTorah for chulin. So now we have a little bit of an exception to the rule for Rabbi Shmuel, which is there was basar chulin in the Midbar. It just has to be something that couldn't have gone on the mizbeach, including tzvi and ayal. So going back to our introduction to the Masechta, that we spoke about the idea of shchita, zvicha, the eating of basar outside the Mikdash, being a parallel to the way that it's done in the Mikdash, and therefore it has certain requirements, including shchita, which is something that's a simulation of what you would do to the animal if you bring it as a korban, the fact that you can't eat the dam, which would have gone on the mizbeach, and you can't eat the chalavim, that would have gone on the mizbeach. But here, this strengthens that idea that the only time there was an isur of basar chulin in the Midbar is with that direct association when you could have brought it as a korban. And therefore, the permission to have basar chulin is really in the context of you should be bringing this as a korban. You should really bring this as a shlamim in order to eat the meat. We're giving you a dispensation not to do it. But that correlation is very acute over here, because the only meat of chulin that was asur in the Midbar was something that you could otherwise have brought as a korban. By Rabbi Yirmiya, Everei basar nechira shechnisu Yisrael imahem la'aretz mahu. The Everim of basar nechira means that they had leftover stuff from the Midbar. They brought it into Eretz Yisrael. The question is, could they eat from that which they brought in from the Midbar? Nechira was allowed in the Midbar, but it's not allowed, according to Rabbi Akiva, once you enter into Eretz Yisrael. So now they're in Eretz Yisrael, but they took in some of the meat that they already had shechted, quote-unquote, in the Midbar, which was through Nechira. Now they're carrying in that meat into Eretz Yisrael. It's interesting because in their day, the application of this would have been very short because the shelf life of meat was very limited. Although, if you salted it heavily, or you made it into like a beef jerky, right, it could have lasted a long time. We're going to see that the Gemara even suggests that it lasted for several years. But nevertheless, the question is only relevant for Rabbi Akiva. Obviously, it's not relevant for Rabbi Shmuel because Rabbi Shmuel doesn't believe that there was ever basar nechira. Now, the Gemara says, Eimat, when exactly are you speaking about? Ilema b'sheva shekabshu. If you're talking about in the first 7 years while they were conquering Eretz Yisrael, Hashto davar tamei ishtari lohu. There, even something that was tamei was allowed for them to eat. Dichti, because the pasuk says there, when you come into Eretz Yisrael, Vayak, yibiyacha, Hashem lokecha laaretz, asher nishba la'avotecha, Avram, Yitzhak, Yaakov, latet lach, arim gidolot v'tovot, asher lo banita. You're going to bump into all these things. Ubatim bleim kol tov. And houses full of all these goodies. Asher lo mileta, that you never put there. Uborot chatzuvim, asher lo chatzavta. and there are cisterns that are dug out, quarried out, that you never quarried. Kremim v'zeitim, asher lo natata. And there are vineyards and olive orchards that you never planted. V'achalta v'savata. You can eat and you can enjoy that. So the drosha is that you're going to go into Eretz Yisrael, and it says, and the pasuk says, v'achalta v'savata. Go ahead and enjoy yourself. It's clear whatever kol tov was inside of these houses wasn't kosher because there was no din of shechita for Ben Noach, and there's no requirement that they don't eat dvarim tmeim, and yet it says, Mleim kol tov, and these houses are going to be full of all these goodies, and you can go ahead and v'achalta v'savata. We're not just speaking about dvarim tmeim, cows that weren't shechted properly. We're speaking about katlei dechazire, which would be sidewalls of pig. But if you look in Rashi, Rashi says bacons. It was bacon. So they had bacon that was hanging out in their houses in Eretz Yisrael. That means when they came and conquered Eretz Yisrael, they were allowed to eat the bacon that they found inside of these houses. I mean, they could eat anything, but this is just an example of what they could eat when they came into Eretz Yisrael. It says, basar nechira miboyi. If you're telling me they're eating chazir in Eretz Yisrael when they came in, what do you mean, basar nechira? Why is that even a question? Mean that if they did nechira at that point in time, should have been kasher. Forget about what they did in the midbar. Even the stuff that they do when they come into Eretz Yisrael should be fine. Elaleachar mikan, later on. So that means that after the 7 years. That means that they preserved the basar for the 7 years, and then that basar nechira that they brought in from the midbar, now they want to know if they can eat it after the 7 years, if you wanted to eat it after the 7 years, but you would have to have preserved it for an extensive period of time. That's the question. It's even about the first 7 years. Because what was permitted to them was that which they found, the booty that they found when they came into Eretz Yisrael, that's what's permitted. Did who? Lo yishtari. But stuff that you did, meaning that if you did nechira on something when you came into Eretz Yisrael, that's not going to be mutar. You go ahead and find a pig in Eretz Yisrael, that's not going to be mutar. It's only the booty, only the houses that you find that have this stuff in it, that's what's permitted to you. So that's a difference. Then even in the first 7 years, your basar nechira, it's a question. Because your only permission is for things that you find that are already made, already put together. But if stuff that you did in Eretz Yisrael, certainly, then you can't have it. Now the question is, the stuff you brought from the midbar, which was done to Heter, is that permissible right now? Gemara leaves this as a teiko, as an unresolved issue. So first of all, Rashi makes a comment over here, which usually the Gemara will make a statement about such a question, which is, madahava hava. Whatever happened, happened. Why do we care? I mean, there's no meaningful halachic impact or outcome from this, so why does it make a difference? So Rashi says, v'drosh v'kabel scharhu. This is just to learn and get schar. She'tzrichim anu lamod al ha'emet. We need to know the truth. V'afu pish kvar avar, even though it passed. So Rashi sees it as, even though the Gemara in some places says madahava hava, he says there's still a value over here to understand the psukim and understand what happened. And getting to the truth is something that's important in the Torah. Even if it doesn't have practical application right now, just understanding what they did when they came to Eretz Yisrael is of importance. That's the first thing Rashi said. The second thing is, this Gemara is striking. That means that when they came into Eretz Yisrael for the first 7 years, they were basically not keeping many of the mitzvot HaTorah. They're eating treif. They are partaking of all these things that they're finding in these houses. And it's no surprise then, that later on, in the time of the Shoftim, maybe they have a hard time bringing the people together and having them do what is right. There was a lot of freedom in the earlier part in the conquest, so you could see the people then having to buckle down might have been a little bit difficult. I just say that as a side comment. Now, what's interesting here is, how extensive is this heter that's brought by the Gemara here, that you can eat all this stuff that is not kosher? The Rambam, when he codifies this halacha, says something which takes a little bit of the sting out of what we just read. And he says, Chalutzei tzava, shinkansu bigvul ha'akum. If you have the earlier raiders or the people that go in to fight against the non-Jews, bikapshum bishbumehem, and they conquer them and they take captives from them, mutar lahem lechol nevelot v'treifot u'basar chazir o'kayotzebo. They can eat all things that are non-kosher. Im yirav. Lo matzah mayukam. If he's starving and he has nothing to eat. Ela ma'akalot elu hasurim. With the exception of these items that are available that are asurim. V'chein shote yayin nesef. And he can even drink yayin nesef, which is associated with Vodah Zarah. Mipi ha'shmua lamdu. And we learn this through the Mesorah. Ubatim aleim koltuv. Orfei chazirim ikoyotzvem. So yes, instead of kotlei chazirim, he has orfei, the necks of the pigs. But you see that the Rambam for very, very much narrows the scope of this heter and also does something that's interesting. He first of all has application of it more broadly. He says when you come begvulakum, that's number one. He doesn't mention where or what the context is. He says when you're fighting an enemy. Number two is he says it seems to be only a heter of pikuach nefesh. You have nothing else to eat, so then you can eat these items. The third chiddush in the Rambam is chein shoteh yayin nesef. Even things that are takrovet avodah zarah, you can eat or drink in this context. So the Ramban, in his Perush al Torah, when he speaks about the pasuk that we just quoted in the Gemara, he brings the Gemara down. He says, "Ba'adat rabuteinu yirmozod, ki'atovahu asher yimatzei ba'batim amleim, mutar, afilu yesh shem dvarim enesarim b'torah, kagon kadlei techazirei," the third adjective of what the part of the pig it was, "O kramim nituim klaim orla." He says that you could take anything. Binehu trulehem koli sirim zulati isura avodah zarah. The only exception to that is avodah zarah. It says in the psukim, you can't take the kesef zahav, all the things that were associated with avodah zarah, that you have to rid yourself of. So you have anything of isur, with the exception of avodah zarah. He says, "Bineh heter zeh ad shachlu shlalo vehem." This heter only applies until they consumed all the booty that they got from their enemies. Yeshomrim sheva shekavshu. That by sheva shekavshu. Keni rabba gemara. V'arav kotei b'ilchot melachim u'milchoteihem. The Rav, referring to the Rambam, writes in Hilchot Melachim, and he quotes the Rambam. And he says, v'ein zenachom. The Rambam is clearly wrong. He says, shalo bishvil pikuach nefesh u'ra'avon b'yovad u'tar b'shat milchama. It has nothing to do with pikuach nefesh. The problem is, if it is pikuach nefesh, what does it have to do with going into Eretz Yisrael? That's any time. That's a blanket heter for anything you need pikuach nefesh. Ela lachar shekavshu arim hagdolot v'atovot v'yashvu behem giter lahem shlalo behem. When you conquer these great big cities and these big houses, you can eat the shalal. Belo b'chol chalutzei tzava. And it's not in every battle or any situation. Ela ba'aretz asher nishba avoteinu latet lanu. It's only in the conquest of Eretz Yisrael. So Ramban argues him on all three points. He says, number one, it's not about a broad battle. It's only about the conquest of Eretz Yisrael. And in the context of Sukkim, maybe just the Shiva Amamim. Maybe the seven nations in the conquest of Eretz Yisrael. That's number one. Number two is, he says, that the heter is a broad heter. Nothing to do with pikuach nefesh. Anytime there's something of Isur that you get in these batim aleim kotuv, that is up, open, and available to you. And, as you noted, and I think it's correct, he does not limit it to the army. It's something that's available to anybody who was involved in the conquest, which means all of B'nai Yisrael can utilize or take whatever was in these batim and get benefit from it. The third thing that he argues on the Rambam about is the yayin. He says that the yayin nesech is a part of avodah zarah. And avodah zarah are the things that are the exception to the rule. So takrovet avodah zarah should have been excluded, and therefore you can't drink the yayin nesech. The Ramban, in a separate count, in the battles against Sichon and Og, in Bamidbar Lamed Aleph Pasuk Chav Gimel, discusses why was the battle of Sichon and Og different than Midian. The Torah, after the battle of Midian, first of all says that you have to kosher all the kelim that you took from Midian, because they were non-kosher kelim. Number two is anybody who became Tameh in the battle has to become Tahor. The Ramban, in addressing the issue as to why in the battle of Sichon and Og, which took place before that, why was there no necessity to kosher that which they found? And number two is, why did they have to become Tahor from being Tameh? He says that, Vatam, Ki Sichon v'Og Malchei Morihim, V'artzam Minachalat Yisrael Hi. Sichon and Og are part of the Yerusha. V'huter Lehem Shlalam, Afilu Ha'isurim. The Ramban applies this din not only to inside of Eretz Yisrael, but even to Eber Yardain, because Sichon and Og are part of the Nachala of Bnei Yisrael. They are part of what was promised And they are Malchei and Mori. And Mori are one of the Shiva Amamim. And therefore the conquest of Sichon and Og has the same din as what's mentioned here in the Gemara, that you are allowed to eat from anything you want, even Isur. And that means that the pots and all those things were open and available to you. You didn't need to kasher them because they were found lame kotub. You can eat them b'isur. Aval Mijam o yamishalahem. Mijam was not one of those areas that's under the kibush haaretz. And therefore, v'lolachu et artzam. And we never conquered their land. We just fought a battle and then took shlal from the battle. Rak linkom nikmatam hargu odam. It was to do the nikama for what had happened by Baal Peor. V'lachu shalalam. That's why they were Isurim. That's how he distinguishes between the battle of Sichon and Og, where we never hear about kashering Kelim, and Mijan, where we do. Why all of a sudden here, by the battle of Mijan, do we acquire all this Tuma and Tara and dealing with that, and never mentioned by Sichon and Og? Kimichemet Sichon va'og ba, hayu kol Yisrael, v'tum'ahu trabit zibur. That's something amazing. He says that, because by Sichon and Og, all of Bnei Israel were involved in the battle, therefore it was Tuma Hotra B'Tzibor. But where the battles, Midian, is only army that was carrying out these battles, and therefore the Tuma was uniquely associated with those in the army. That's why there they worried about Tuma. Very interesting, Ramban. And then I just mentioned that the Ramban, later on in Bamidbar, also speaks about Eretz Sichon V'Og, and there he, I would say, vacillates a little bit about the Kedusha of Eivor HaYarden. Moshe seems to indicate that it's only because Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven asked for the land in Eivor HaYarden that Moshe granted to them. Had it not been for that, Moshe Rabbeinu would have forced them all to take Yerusha in Eretz Yisrael. That would imply that Eivor HaYarden is not part of the lands that were promised to Bnei Yisrael. That's number one. Number two is Moshe is opening B'Shalom to Sichon and Og. He offers them, let us pass through your land to get to Eretz Yisrael. Which means that he would have had taken up the option had they given permission to go straight through, not conquer them, and conquer an Eretz Yisrael. So the Ramban discusses why Moshe Rabbeinu did that, what was the permission to do such. But then he speaks about the fact that Eivor HaYarden does not carry the same kedusha as Eretz Yisrael. You can't build the Mikdash there. The Shekhinah is not Shoreh there. And the most striking pasuk is the one in Yoshua that says, when Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven are going back to Eivor HaYarden, they build a Mizbeach, and then people get wind of it, and they think that they're seceding from Bnei Israel, they're leaving the Mishkan, and they go after them. In that speech over there, they say, if you think that your land is Eretz Tmeyahi, that your land is a land that is defiled, so they define Eivor HaYarden as being an Eretz Tmeyah, vis-a-vis the Eretz HaKdosha in Eretz Israel. So there the Ramban, as opposed to what he says before, that conquest of Sichon and Og were part of conquest of Eretz, there he seems to be backpedaling a little bit. There are those that suggest that the Ramban's view would have been that had they taken all the land in Eretz Yisrael, that every one of the Shvatim would have gotten a strip or a piece in Eivor HaYarden that would be parallel to where they were in Eretz Yisrael, and that would be the way they would have dealt with it had it not been that Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven had asked for that land. But that's the sheet that the Ramban, the Radvaz, Kedarka Bakodesh, Vinci was the Rav in the same location, comes to the defense of the Rambam. And his defense of the Rambam is exactly along the lines of what you were suggesting, which is the Rambam is not speaking about the Shiva Amamim. The Rambam is speaking about battles that happen when it's not the Shiva Amamim. And the reason he does that is because the Shiva Amamim is Madahava Hava. That was in the past. It has no relevance. He's posturing Halacha Lemaase. Halacha Lemaase is when we're in battle, Chalutzei Tzava. But then how do you get over the problem of Pikuach Nefesh? He says that the Rambam does not say that only in Pikuach Nefesh are you allowed to eat it. He says, B'shat Rav, when you guys are hungry. What he says is that normally, if you were hungry, we'd say to you, go get the proper food that you need. In situations when you're in battle or you're sieging on a city, you're in a situation where you've reached Gvul Ha'akum, that's how the Rambam terms it, then we no longer have this demand on you to go get kosher food. If what's available to you through the shlal, whatever's there, is non-kosher food, we don't trouble you to go get kosher food in order to be in the battle. Because, and he says over here, the same reason you're allowed to siege the city on Shabbat. Even though you're not supposed to be in battle at Shabbat, we know that if you don't siege the city through Shabbat, your siege is never going to work. If you give up the siege every time that it comes to Shabbat, it's not going to be much of a siege. Same problem that the Chashmonaim had, the Maccabim, when they originally went to battle. And the Gemara speaks about this idea, they wouldn't battle on Shabbat. said you can't violate Shabbat, so they stopped battling on Shabbat. So the enemies got wind of this. Every time on Shabbat, they would counterattack, and they were losing huge things until they realized that it's pikuach nefesh, and you're allowed to battle on Shabbat as well. And that changed the whole dynamic. So similarly over here, the fact is, if you don't allow them to eat from the shlalach, what's there, when they're hungry, then you're going to run yourselves into a either demoralized army, or an army that is constantly in search of kosher food. Not like today, we can just bring it in packages. They have to get animals chefed. It'd be very difficult. So that difficulty, we waive in the context of milchama. And that's how the Radbaz explains the Rambam. It's not an issue of pikuach nefesh, but rather an issue of convenience and waging war, which requires certain dispensations. And this is one of those dispensations that the Rambam lifts out of this sugya here, where the Gemara, in a stronger sense, says you can eat non-kosher, period, without any of these requirements. Over here, the Rambam has two requirements to engage it. One has to be b'gvul oyev. You have to be within the boundaries of the oyev. And number two is you have to be where you're at. The guy's really hungry, starving, and he needs to eat it. Not just willy-nilly that he wants to eat it. So that is the way that the Radbaz deals with the Rambam. He also speaks about the issue of Tumah as well, as to why it was different. But anyway, it's interesting. Sugi, I sent you the Mekorot. But amazing to think about the fact that they were eating bacon while conquering Eretz Yisrael. Now the Gemara says, Amar Rabba, Shanita, you explained to me, if you remember in the Mishnah has three statements that are generic statements. And we explained that all of them. It says, Hakol Shochatim, Ulolam Shochatim, Ubechol Shochatim. The first one we explained, Hakol Shochatim, was not referring to who can do the Shkita, but rather you have to do Shkita for everything, including oath, which we'll see as a machloket later on in the Masechta. So Hakol Shochatim means even oath you have to shech. The Olam Shochatim is what we just dealt with, which was, according to Rabbah, that was a reference to Rabbi Shmuel, and according to Rabbi Yosef, a reference to Rabbi Kiva. That means that once you had Shkita, Shkita always remains in place as the heter for Chulin. And now we have the last word there, or last generic statement there, which is Ubachol Shochatim, that you can shech with anything. That means any utensil, it sounds like. So that's what Rabbah is referencing to. He says, Amar Rabbah, Shanita. You already explained Hakol Shochatim, Uleolam Shochatim. You explained both of those. B'chol Shochatim, my Mishanitle. What are you going to say about the words B'chol Shochatim? B'chi Teima, if you want to say that the meaning is Ben Bitzur, Ben Bitzuchuchit, Ben Bikumit Shalkaneh, it's telling you you can use all these different types of sharp objects to do Shkita, whether it's a flint stone, glass, or a reed palm. Ha Dumya Dahanach Ktani. Wait a minute, you need it to be similar to those that are already written. Ihanach bishokhatim. If the other two were with the subject is the person who's doing the shechita, hainabi bishokhatim. That should be the subject over here. Ihanach benishchatim. If it's referencing to those that are being shechted, that's the object of the shechita, hainami benishchatim. So to over here, it should be consistently with the object. So what he's pointing out is now there's an inconsistency in the explanation. You explain a kol shochatim to refer to birds. That's the object of the shkita. You said the olam shochatim has to do with the object of your shkita. Meat, basar chulin, always needs to be shechted. Object again. Then you come and tell me, b'chol shochatim is not a reference to the object, but rather to the subject. The person doing the shkita can do it with any one of these utensils. You've actually flipped the reference in these generic statements. He says you've got to be consistent. Either it's all speaking about the object, which is the bird, the behemah, now you have to come up with something over here, or it's all speaking about the individual who's performing this shkita, which is what you're suggesting now, that it means these utensils that you have, you can use any of them. So you have to be consistent. Elo Amar Rova, you can see in the Masorah HaShas, he changes Amar Rabba to Amar Rova, because then Elo Amar Rova would be him explaining this whole thing. Otherwise, you have to say that Rabba is going to pose the question. Rova comes now to answer that question, which is Elam Rava, Hakol Shochatim. We have the word Hakol Shochatim twice, once in the first Mishnah, once in the Mishnah that we just saw on Tetzayin Amud Bet. And that Hakol Shochatim comes to teach you, number one, Chad Letuye Kuti, to tell you that a Kuti's Shchita is Kshira, Chad Letuye Yisrael Mumar, and the other one to tell you that an Yisrael Mumar's Shchita is okay. We already discussed this earlier, what exactly is a mumar for, and which mumarim are okay, which mumarim are not okay. But over here you have both, one to include a kuti and one to include Yisrael mumar. The problem with that a little bit is the Gemara back on Gimel Amud Bet, when it was trying to decide what the meaning of the Mishnah was, brought down five different explanations within the Amoraim. And then the Gemara asks about Rava's position. Rava brought a position about referencing to a Kuti. Then it says there, Rava, Mayata Adama Lo Amar Kishmatate. Why doesn't he hold like his own Shita? Which is that Rav Ashi quotes Rava to explain the Gemara as referring to a Israel Mumar. Gemara answers, the Dvarav Da Abaye Kamar, Velelo Svirle. He wanted to explain Abaye's position. Abaye said that a Nichnas V'yotze by a Kuti is not enough. And Rava said, yes, it is enough. A Nichnas V'yotze is sufficient by a Kuti. So he just wanted to tell Abaye you're wrong. But then, Velelo Svirle, he doesn't really hold that a Kuti can do Shechita. The Balei Tosafot on the bottom of Gimel Amud Bet say, Tema, ha'tani b'matiten shrei ha'kol shochtim. The word kol shochtim appears twice. Umefarish Rava on our daf, chadale tuye kuti, v'chadale tuye Yisrael mumar. So what do you mean Rava doesn't hold of kuti? Rava says over here, the kol shochtim, one of them comes to include a kuti. So why are you saying he doesn't hold like a baye and say that it isn't a kuti? Alma muki chadale kishmate. He does think that one of them is a kuti. He says that you should have made that the first one, which is that Rava spoke about Yisrael Mumar. Tosafot's answer is not as strong as his question. His question is very strong, which is Rava does include a Kuti, and the Gemara back there says Rava does not believe that a Kuti is okay. So Tosafot in the end says the question of the Gemara is not whether Rava really believes that a Kuti is okay. It's a question of if you have two Akol Shochatims, the first one, what would you include from it? And the second one, what would you include from it? So the Gemara is asking, why did he include a kuti from the first one? He should have followed his own position and included a mumar in the first one. The Gemara's answer is, that's right. He really does. He was answering Abai's question. Leilo Sfirle doesn't mean that he doesn't hold of it. It means that he doesn't think that's the first thing he would have included. Kosho Chatin, the first one includes a mumar. The second one includes a kuti. I would say it's a difficult answer, or not as strong an answer as a question, but just be aware of it. Lo'olam shochatim means ben bayom, ben balayla, ben barosh agag, ben barosh haspina. Again, this is a bright and a Mishnah that's going to be upcoming that we discussed already, that you can shecht any time, whether it's the daytime, whether it's night. Night is when there's an avukah, when you have a torch there to light it up. Ben barosh agag, on the roof, we don't worry about people saying that you're shechting l'tzva ha-shamayim. And ben barosh haspina, you're allowed to shecht on the boat, even though we say that you're not allowed to shecht in the yam and have the blood go into the ocean, because it looks like you're shechting the Sara yam. Rashi claims that this is an exception to the rule, that if you're on a boat, you can't shecht to the yam because it's barura davar. It's muchach. The reason you're doing this is because you don't want to get the boat dirty, not because you want to dump the blood to the Sara shel yam. The Balei Tosafot back when we originally had this on Yud Gimel Amud Bet argues on Rashi over there and says that even when you shecht it by the boat, you have to shecht it with the blood running down the side of the boat and then into the water, not directly into the water. Right? B'chol shochatim, now, with everything you can do, shechita, ben mitzur, ben mitzvukit, ben mikumit, shokaneh. And in this way, Rava now makes a consistency in all of these generic terms, which is all speaking about the individual doing the shechita. The individual that's doing the shechita can be a kuti, can be a mumar. They can do it at night, during the day, on the gag, on the spina. And they can use any one of these utensils. And that way he explains all of them in a consistent manner. Right now, the Gemara goes back to the Mishnah and starts discussing about knives. Says, chutz, mi magal katsir va migeira. Says, you're not allowed to use a harvest scythe or a saw in order to do the shechita. Avua de Shmuel, pagam vishadar, pagam vishadar. He used to make nicks in the knives, and then he used to send them off to Eretz Yisrael, and ask them, is this kasher, is this kasher, is this knife okay, is this knife okay? So he's making all these nicks in there, trying to figure out what exactly is problematic. Shauchulei kemigeira shaninu. They sent back to him that the restriction is like a saw. A saw has multiple teeth in it, and that's what causes the problem. Number one, it has multiple teeth. Number two is the sharpness of each tooth is in both directions. It's a bidirectional cutting instrument. Meaning that when you cut with a harvest scythe, there's only one direction in which you cut with it because the teeth are turned very heavily inward and they only catch in one direction. They don't catch in the other direction. In fact, well, it's the fact that it's curved. Some say that it's not curved, it's a straight one, but either way, it only functions really in one direction. And the saw functions in both directions and has multiple teeth in it. That's what they're sending back to Abu Adi Shmuel. Tanra Banan. Sakin Shiesh Ba Pigimot Harbei. If you have a knife that has many nicks in it, Tidon Kimigera, then it has a din like a saw, and obviously that would be problematic for Shechita. V'she'en ba'ala pigima achat, on the other hand, if it only has one nick in it, ogeret psula. If it's something that catches, then it is psula. Misuchsechet, if it is flattened out, if it is smoothed out, it is ksheira. So Gemara wants to know, heichidami ogeret, heichidami misuchsechet. What does that mean? Define for me these terms so I know when the nick in the knife is problematic. Amar Rabbi Elazar, ogeret, mishtei ruchot. Ogeret means that the nick will catch in both directions. Misuchsechet, on the other hand, if it's smoothed out, meruach achat, it will only catch in one direction. So now, what the Gemara is indicating at this point is that if you ran your finger along the knife, and again here you can see in the picture, so you ran your finger along the knife, and your nail, which extends a little bit beyond your finger, would catch in the nick. That means both if you were going down the knife and then up the knife, the nick would catch your fingernail in both directions. That's called ogeret. From the word oger means to gather together, to collect. So that's the same thing over here. Oger means it'll catch in both directions. It will pull in both directions. On the other hand, if it's a misuchsechet, which Rashi describes over here, you had what otherwise would have been a nick that would have caught in both directions. But then you took it into the sharpening stone. And on the sharpening stone, you smoothed out one side. So now there's a drop in the knife. There's a sharp drop in the knife in one direction, but not in the other direction. So if you were coming down the knife, it would catch. But you go up the knife, it would just fall down that and decline and not really catch on that direction. So it's unidirectional in its catching. That's the difference between them. Gemara says, Maishna mishtei ruchot. Why does it make a difference if it catches in both directions? The mursha kama machlish. Because what we assume is that the sharpness, the mursha means here the sharpness or the edge of the nick will cut. And over here, it will weaken it. Weakening it here really means it'll start the cut. Umosha batra, and then the second edge will buzza, will rip or tear the simanim. So what your fear is that when you have something that has a catch in both directions, as you move it along, the nick in the one direction has two edges to it, this nick. So the first, as you move it along, the first edge will cause a certain amount of weakening or cutting of the item. The second edge will actually cut the item. And in that way, when you're doing the shechita, you're going to end up ripping the simanim rather than cutting the simanim. Because the first edge is going to allow you to get depth into the cut, and then the second edge is going to catch and cause a baza, a ripping of the item. So that's why when it's two directions, the catch, that's why it's a problem. So he says, Miruach achat nami. Why don't you say the same thing when it's only a unidirectional catch? Because chorfa de sakina machlish, flat blade, until you reach that point, will cut or get the knife in deeper. And then morsha buzza. Then the nick or the catch will tear at that point in time. Meaning that you can simulate the effect of a nick that catches in both directions. A nick that catches in both directions, there the problem is more acute. Because the catch itself will have two cuts. It'll have one cut when you drop down the first catch. And then it'll cut again when it rises up the other side of the catch. So one of those will cut, the other one will tear. But even with a unidirectional catch, there you still have a part of the knife that's smooth that gets there beforehand. So as you move along, the smoothness of a knife will cause depth of the knife, will cause the knife to get deeper. And then when you hit the catch, that will actually tear the simanim. So you have the same problem now if you have a single catch. And so why is it okay when it's a misuchsechet? And as Rashi points out, that even though later on we're going to see by the Magal Katsir, which does have teeth in a unidirectional manner, because they're folded over very heavily, Beit Hillel over there says that it is makshir if you cut away from the teeth on the smoother side of the Magal Katsir. So So Rashi says there's a difference over there. Because the points are so curved or so flattened over, there's no sharp edge to them. On the other hand, when you have a knife that has a nick in it, the sharpness of the nick cuts in either direction, whether it's oleh, meaning it catches, or it's yored, or it drops down, it's coming towards it and then drops into the nick, it's able to cut in both directions. That's true when there's sharpness to the nick that's there. If it's so folded over, so curved, so that you don't feel that drop or that nick at all, then it won't have any impact. And that's the difference between a magal katsir and the situations here of misuch sechet. Because here in misuch sechet, one edge of it is still sharp, and whether the knife drops over there or is going up over there, it's going to catch in both directions, and that's why it's problematic. It says, the kaim aresha de sakina. It is at the edge or the tip of the sakin of the knife. So that way, it's not in the middle of the knife, which is what we assumed until now, which means either if it's a dual catch, then the catch itself will cause cutting and ripping. If it's a single catch, the smooth part of the knife that went before it will cause depth or cutting, and then the catch will cause the ripping or the tearing or the problem. But now we're saying, no, it's all the way at the tip of the knife. So now, if it's at the tip of the knife, it all happens when you initially put the knife in. Meaning that that'll be the first thing that goes in, and the first thing that goes in, okay, so it cuts a little bit, but what's the big deal? It's not going to be bazaar. So, ki azla machlusha. Okay, in the end, what's going to happen is when you push the knife through, so the tip of the knife went first, it's cutting, it's not reaching the simanim. Ki ato, when you move the knife back the other direction, bazaar, it's going to end up tearing, it's going to end up causing a problem. Meaning that the way that you do shkita is you go back and forth, back and forth. That motion, you're right, the initial motion of going forward is not going to be a problem because your nick is at the tip of the knife. But when you're coming back the other way, that's going to create a problem because that by that time it's already going to have depth and then it can tear at that point in time. It says, okay, so you only went unidirectionally. You only went in a single direction. Molech HaMevi is only a necessity to prevent darsa, to prevent you from cutting through pressure rather than a cutting motion. The Gemara is going to tell us later on that if you have a knife that's the size of two necks, then you'd actually only have to go in one direction because you have enough to cut through the entirety of the neck with a single motion of the knife. So the molech HaMevi is not an absolute requirement. It's a requirement to avoid drisa. So if you can cut without doing the drisa, then if you want a single motion, it'll be fine. So over here, again, b'diavad, if you used such a knife, it would be kashera. We would not advocate doing this. But if he did use such a knife where the cut was in the beginning and it only went unidirectionally, that would be kasher b'diavad. Amarava, gimel midot b'sakin. There are three different types of knives. Ogeret. If it's ogeret, which you already described, means that it catches in both directions. The nick catches in both directions. Lo yishkot. There, even b'diavad, you can't use it because you already described that the sharpness of one edge is going to cause the cutting. The sharpness of the other edge is going to cause tearing. And tearing of the simanim is a problem in the shechita. V'im shachat, and if you did a shechita, shechitato psulat, completely pasul. Misuch sechet, that's the second case that we described, which is that you have a single catch in the nick. You smooth out the other side of the catch. Lo yishchot balechatfila, as we noted, you shouldn't shecht with the chatfila. V'im shachat, shechitato kshera. If you do the shechita, then the shechita is kshera b'diavad, with the qualification that it's at the front end of the knife, that it's not in the middle of the knife. You would have to qualify that, because that we already explained before. And oleh v'yored v'sakin shochet b'chatzila. If it's a knife that goes up and down, then you can even use that knife l'chatzila. That is, as Rashi describes over here, a knife that had some sort of nick in it. In order to take out the nick, they did a much broader sharpening of the knife, at which they made the knife have a gentle decline and incline, or a gentle protrusion, or even ups and downs in the knife. But the ups and downs of the knife are smooth, much more flat ups and downs, and therefore they don't catch. If you ran your finger on them, they wouldn't catch at all, because they're too wide. A nick is going to be much smaller, and that's what's going to cause the catch. And that's what causes the sharpness, that's the problem. On the other hand, if you have much wider and deeper types of movements up and down on the knife, that's not an issue because of the fact that it doesn't catch. It just cuts. If it doesn't catch, it's not going to tear. It's not going to cause you the problems that a nick would cause you in the knife. So now, Amale Ravuna, brother of Nechemiah, the Rav Ashi. Amartlan Mishmei de Rava. You said over to us in the name of Rava. So this is Ravuna, brother of Nechemiah, speaking to Rav Ashi. He says, you told us in the name of Rava. We know that Rava never saw Rav Ashi, because Rava died on the day that Rav Ashi was born. So there's no way that Rav Ashi learned something from Rava. And that's what Rashi says over here. We've actually seen this in other places where the Rashbam mentions it as well. But he says, Kohei Kadamar Mishmei de Ploni. Anytime the Gemara tells you that you're saying something over Mishmei de Ploni, Lo Sham Ami Menu. He did not hear it directly from him. Ela Me'acherim Shama Shekablu Ami Menu. It's hearsay. He heard it from someone who heard it from the person who said it. He had Rav Ashi. Lo Ra'at Rava Me'olam. Like over here, Rav Ashi never saw Rava. And therefore, when Rav Ashi says, I heard, you told us over in the name of Rava, he was saying the name of Rava, but not because it was Amar Rava, that he actually physically heard it from Rava. Misuk Sechet Psula. That a Misuk Sechet is problematic. Wait a minute, we just said that Misuk Sechet is at least Kasher Bidyabad, and that was a statement of Rava. Now you have a statement from Rava saying that Misuk Sechet is problematic. Veha. Now, here is a question as to whether it's Ha Amar Rava, or it's a possibility that the Shilta quotes this as a Braita. Vatanya. Misuk Sechet Sheira. So either Rava said it, or we have a Braita that said it. We already know that Rava said it above. But it might be even a Braita that says it, that Bidyabad, it's okay. Lokasha. Kansholich Vehevi. Kansholich Veloevi. It's the same qualification that we mentioned before. The only time that a Misuk Sechet is okay is when it's at the tip of the knife. Number one. Number two is, it is only when you're going unidirectionally. It's only when you're going in a single direction. But if you go back and forth, then it would be pasul, even bidyavad, and that will explain the difference between their positions over here. So now, in conclusion of what we've learned so far, if you have a knife with multiple nicks in it, it does not matter whether those nicks catch in both directions, or they only catch in one direction. If you have multiple nicks in it, it's no good, because then you have maklish and bazaar, and you can't use that knife. If it's a knife that has a single nick in it, then if it's ogeret, if it is catching in both directions, you cannot use that knife. If it's misuk sechet, it only catches in a single direction, then with the two qualifications, you can use it bidyabad, which is if it's at the tip of the knife, number one, and number two is you're only cutting unidirectionally in one single direction, you're not going back and forth. That's the conclusion we came to so far. Amalei Ravacha, brother of Avya, the Ravashi, Damio Lisasa Mai. If it's similar to an on, what is the din over here? As Rashi explains over here, this is what we call the Zkana Shibalim. You look at the heads of wheat. The heads of wheat have little sections where the kernels are found. And around those sections is this fuzzy stuff that grows around the area where the kernels are kept. That fuzzy stuff is what he's describing over here. I have a knife that is not smooth, but it's also not sharp. I mean, it's not a nick. If you ran your finger along it, it wouldn't catch. But on the other hand, if you ran your finger along it, you could feel that it's not smooth. So it's, I would call it quasi-serrated. So the edge of the knife is a little rough, but it doesn't have any nicks or notches in it. What's the din of this? Someone should give us meat that was shekel like that and we could eat it. I mean, he's saying it's kasher. That shouldn't be a problem because, again, the whole problem of a nick is the catching aspect of it. And so over here, if you run your finger on it, it would not be smooth, but it also would not catch. If it doesn't catch, then there's no issue at all. Now we move on to what's called bidikat sakin. How do you check the knife to see if there are these nicks that are problematic in the knife? Amrav Chista, minayin bidikat sakin min haTorah. How do you know that min haTorah you have to check your knife? Shenemar, because it says by when Shaul finds the people after the defeat of the Plishtim, seems like they're eating meat without shechita or some problem there. Where Shaul says to them, "Vayomer Shaul, pitzu ba'am, v'amartem lahem, hagishu elai ish shoro v'ish seyu, shkatetem bazeh, v'achaltem lo techetu la'Hashem." Because the psukim before say that they were lechol al adam. They were eating. It's not clear what exactly they were doing wrong, but it was clear that there was something wrong, that he needed to do shkita. But he says, ushchatetem bazeh, with this, saying that he has a particular object, which he's demanding that they use for the shkita, v'chaltem, then you can eat. So the ushchatetem bazeh shows you that the chacham has to check it beforehand. Here Shaul, the gadol ador then, is the one checking the knife and then giving it to them to do the shechita with. Gemara says, pshita, what's the question? Why do you need a din from the Torah to teach you that you have to check the knife? Kaven dechi nakab trefa bayibidika. Meaning, if you get a nekev in one of the simanim, then you are automatically is deemed to be a trefa. So there, of course, it needs bidika. Meaning that if you have a nick in there, and a nick we know tears, that means that you're actually going to cause what's called chunkim. You're going to cause some sort of puncture of the beshet along the way if you don't check for the knife. So it has nothing to do with checking the knife as a din min haTorah. The din is don't make a trefa. If you don't check, you're going to make a trefa. So that would be obvious that you have to check the knife for that reason. So now Gemara says, l'chacham kamina. How do you know that you have to show the knife to a chacham before you shech? V'amar Rabbi Yochanan, lo amru l'harot sakin l'chacham el m'pnei kvodo shel chacham. Wait a minute, the only reason you have to show a knife to the chacham is not because you need him to check it, it's out of deference, to show that he's the posek and that he's the gadol of the city, he's the gadol ador, wherever it is that you're showing the knife to. But that's a matter of deference, that's not a matter of halachic necessity. Gemara says, midrabanan, v'kra esmakta bi'almahu. It's a din derabbanan that you have to take the knife to the chacham, but the pasuk is a hint to that, or is an asmachta to the fact that you have to show the knife to someone, because Shaul is saying to them, this is the knife you should use, in that he checked the knife, and then he's giving them the knife. All right, now the Gemara says, B'marova badki la b'shimshon. In Eretz Yisrael, they used to check the knife by holding it up to the sun. And holding it up to the sun, it would give them an indication as to whether it's a nick. Rashi over here brings two different possibilities as to what that means. One of them is that you hold it up directly to the sun. A knife is on a horizontal, and then you look up, and then the light would come through any of the nicks that you see when the knife is flat in front of you. The other possibility Rashi brings is that you hold up the knife to the sun, and it casts a shadow on the ground. And the shadow usually is a magnification of what you see on the knife. And then you'll see if there's a nick in the knife, the shadow cast by the knife would have some sort of indentation of light in it, and that would tell you that there's a nick in it. In Nardol, they checked it through water. Again, Rashi brings two possibilities, one of which is what they do today. When they change your tires and they want to check if there's a hole in the tire, they submerge the tire into the water pool, and they see if any bubbles come up. So similarly over here, what they would do is take a knife, and run it across, blade-wise, across a pool of water. If the knife is absolutely smooth, it will not create any ripples in the water. If there's a nick in the knife, it will cause a ripple to extend from the knife, and that way you would know that there was a nick in the knife. Now you could run that in one of two ways. You could run across the blade across, and the nick would cause a ripple, or you could slide the blade horizontally, and also there you would see only smoothness, and there would be some gapping in the middle if there was a nick. That's one way Rashi explains it. The second way Rashi explains it is that you hold the knife up on an angle and you drop a little drop of water on the blade of the knife. The water should slide down the blade of the knife. If the blade of the knife is absolutely smooth, the water will go the whole blade and only fall off at the end of the knife. If there's a nick, that little bit of water will fall off in the middle and then you'll know there's a nick. Rav Sheshet Badakla Beresh Lishne. He used to check it with his tongue. He used to run the knife along his tongue to see if there was a catch. He would feel it with his tongue. I would not try this at home. It might be a little dangerous given how sharp the knives are. Ravacha bar Yaakov badakla b'chut ha-se'ara. He used to take a hair, and he used to run a hair. He'd pull a hair tight, like you do with dental floss, and then he would run it along the knife. And again, if it caught or it tore along the way, he would know that there was a problem with the knife. B'sura Amre, in the surah they used to say, Bisra Akhla, Bisra Labadka. If you're going to eat meat, and that's what you're going to test, you need to test it on meat or flesh. Or in essence, you have to run your finger along the knife. If you're going to be using it to cut meat, you have to use something that is similar to what you're cutting. Because otherwise, you might be too sensitive, and you'll catch a nick that doesn't matter. Or you might be less sensitive when you're using something that's a harder object, and therefore you'll leave a nick that otherwise wouldn't be caught by basar. So you have to use something that's similar to what you're cutting. Amar Papa, Sricha Bedika Bisra Vatufra, it's a question here whether this should be included in the girsa or not, or whether it should say Trei Ruchata or Tlata Ruchata. But nevertheless, we'll read it with Tlata Ruchata, which is, you need to check it with your flesh, your nail, and on three sides. So Rav Papa over here says that you're actually going to have to do 12 checks over here on the knife, which is that you're going to have to run back and forth along the blade of the knife, once with your finger, meaning the basar of your finger, and once with your fingernail running across it. The Bali Tosfot say the reason for that is that Bisra simulates the veshet, the esophagus, which is a softer material, and the nail simulates the kaneh, which is a much harder cartilage. And in that way, you're capturing what the knife is about to cut to see that it won't catch. So then you have to do that along the blade of the knife. So that's four times already. Your finger back and forth, your nail back and forth. And then you have to do it on the two sides of the blade. You have to go back and forth, again, with your finger and your fingernail, which will be a total of 12 checks. Amrle Ravina the Rabashi. Amrlan Rav Sama Breda Mesharsha Mishmech. We have over from Rav Sama Breda Mesharsha in your name. Damart Le Mishmei the Rova. You said over in the name of Rova, Tzricha Bedika Bisra Batufra Batlat Ruchoto. You need to check it with your finger, your nail, and on three sides. Amrle, Abisra Tufra Amre says, he quoted me correctly with regards to the finger and the fingernail. Batlata Ruchoto Lo Amre. But the fact you have to do it on all three sides, I never said that. That's not true. You only have to check the blade. You don't have to check the sides of the knife. Igadamre, Abisra Batufra Batlat Ruchata Amre. He says, I did say over that you have to check with your finger and your fingernail and on all three sides. Mishmei Rova Lo Amre. But I never said it over the name of Rova. It was a memory that it was saying either independent of Rova, or we know that the author of that position here is Rav Papa, and now it's Rova. Rav Papa's a Talmud of Rova. Ravina, Ravacha Brei the Rova, Havu Yatva Kamei Ravashi. They were sitting for Ravashi. Aiti Sakin the Kamei, the Ravashi, the Badka. They brought a knife to Ravashi to check it. Amrle the Ravacha Brei the Rova, Bidka. You go ahead and check it. So Ravashi gives permission for him to check it. Badka Tufra Babisra. He checked it with his nail, with his finger, Batlat Ruchot in all three directions. Amrle Yi Yasher. Great job. Vechena my Rav Kana. And Rav Kana says the same thing. Rav Yemar Amar Atufra Babisra Tzricha. You need to do it with your finger and your fingernail. Atlat Ruchota Lo Tzricha. You don't need it on all three sides. Milo Amar Rabbi Zeira Amar Shmuel. We saw this back on Daf Chet, the top of Daf Chet, which was Rabbi Zeira said in the name of Shmuel, Libain Sakin. If you heated up a knife to the point that it was there, it said red hot or white hot. B'shachat ba, and then you do shchita, shchitato k'sheira. There, the shchita is considered to be k'sheira. Shchiduda kodem libuna, because the sharpness of the knife does the shchita before the heat of the knife does anything to asphyxiate or call as a hole in the animal's simanim. B'kashulan, and over there we queried de'ika tzadim. What about the sides of the knife? You're right, the blade itself is so sharp then it goes first before the heat has any impact. But still the sides of the knife is boiling hot. And as you go up, the sides of the knife now are touching the simanim. And then it will burn basically a hole in the veshet before you've completed getting through the veshet. And a nekev in the veshet is a treifa. So there we are, Beit HaShechita, Mirvach Rovach. And we said over there that the area where you're shechting expands as you cut. The area where you're cutting doesn't stay tight together. It starts to move away from the knife. Given that, as the sharpness knife goes through, it's beating the heat. And the heat on the sides is not sufficient or impactful because the Beit HaShechita is widening as the edges of the knife get through. So he says, if that's the case, Hachanami Beit HaShechita, Mirvach Ravach. Why don't you apply the same principle over here? You're checking the knife on the blade for catches and for nicks, and you're checking the knife on the sides for nicks. Well, the blade, I understand why, because that's going first. But the sides of the knife, even if there are nicks there, they're not going to be impactful because the Beit HaShechita is widening. If it's widening, then whatever's on the side of the knife will not impact on the Shechita. From here, it would seem that you only need to check the blade. You don't need to check the two sides. And here you have Rav Yemar saying this, and he's using Rav Zeira Mar Shmuel as a proof to the fact that you don't have to worry about such a thing. Despite all of that, Rashi says over here, "Vafilu achi kaimalan k'ravacha v'rav kahana v'rav kavashi v'kulu amorai." We paskin like these amoraim who are Ravashi is a batra and it carries a lot of weight in terms of psak halacha. We paskin like all these v'kulu amorai damrei tzricha bisra tufra v'tlat ruchata and all the other amoraim that said You need it on three sides, plus Basra Batufra. The Im Shachach Velo Badak. If you forget and you don't do the Bedika Kodem Shkita, before the Shkita, Bodek Lachash Shkita. You have to do the check afterwards if you didn't do it beforehand. So Rashi says, despite the fact that it seems the Gemara's conclusion is that you don't need to do it on three sides, nevertheless, we are Choshesh, or we pass from like all the swath of Amoraim, including Rav Ashi, who suggests that you have to do it on the blade, two sides, and with Bisra and Tofra, although the first Lashon of Rav Ashi suggests you don't need it on all three sides. Nevertheless, we usually follow the latter Lashon when it's brought in the Gemara. We see that as being a stronger version of whatever was brought in the Gemara. Amar Avuna bar Rav Katina, Amar Rav Shimon Lakish, Shalosh Pigimotem. There are three nicks that are problematic. Pigimat etzem b'pesach. If you chip a bone of a Pesach, there you know that you're not allowed to break the bones of the Korban of Pesach. You violate that law if you have a Pigimat. Pigimat ozen b'bechor. The ear of a Bechor, if it gets a mum in it, then it doesn't have to be brought up as a Korban in the Mikdash and can be eaten by the Kohen in the Gvulin b'mumo. That is when you have a Pigima in the cartilage of the ear. Pigimat mum b'kodoshim. And also, if you have a mum in Kodoshim, that would disqualify it from going on the Mizbeach, and it would become Sulei HaMukdashim. Rav Chisda Amar, af Pigimat Sakin. So also, the Pigima, the nick that is in a Sakin. So now, V'idach, B'chulin lo komairi. Rav Huna didn't bring down the Sakin, because he wasn't dealing with Chulin, he was only dealing with issues of Kodoshim. V'chulam, Pigimatan, K'dei Pigimat HaMizbeach. And each one of these, the nick, is the same nick as the Mizbeach. Bekama Pigimat Mizbeach. And how much is a nick in the Mizbeach that would disqualify the Mizbeach? K'dei Shetach Borbat Siporin. If your nail would catch in the nick. So over here, first of all, for the Mizbeach, you have to have Avanim Shleimot. You have to have whole stones to make the Mizbeach. If there's a Pigima in the stone, the definition of Pigima means if your fingernail catches on that nick, in the stone, they're no longer deemed to be of name Shleimot, and they're not allowed to be used for the Mizbeach. Now, taking that and applying it to what we have here. First of all, by the Sakin. That's what we've been discussing all along. That if you have a nick in the Sakin, if you run your finger along it or your fingernail along it and it catches, that's an indication that the Begima is problematic. That's what we've been discussing until now. The other three issues, by Etzem HaPezach, just means if you chip a bone or you have some break of the bone that has a nail that catches in it, that's considered to be a violation of Etzem Motish Beru Bo. Now, Pigimat Ozen Bechor, Pigimat Mum Kodoshim, both Rashi and Tosavot ask the same question, which is, are they one and the same? Why do you need to tell me about Pigimat Bechor and about Pigimat Kodoshim? Bechor is a form of Kodoshim. So if that's the definition of a Mum by Bechor, why isn't that also the definition of a Mum by Kodoshim? So they both answer that from Bechor, I can't learn Kodoshim, because Bechor is only a male, it's only a Zachar. Kodoshim also have a female in there. And therefore Rashi and Tosafot say that there's also a Bigima, or there is a Mum in the Beit HaRechem of a female, and that would not be learned from Bechor, because it's a different location, it's not exactly visible, and it's softer Basar, so maybe over there the din would be different, so you need to tell me about Mum Kodoshim. So then why did you do the reverse? Why didn't you just tell me about Mum Kodoshim and I would have known about Mum Bechor? The answer to that might be that there might be a higher standard for disqualification from the Korban going on the Mizbeach versus that by a Mum by Bechor. Because we have an explicit Mishnah in Bechorot that says these are the Mumim that are posel for a Korban to go on the Mizbeach, but are not good enough to be posel for Bechor. So there are things that work by Kodoshim that don't work by Bechor. So therefore I have to tell you both Mumim. I have to tell you the Mum by the Bechor and the Mum by Kodoshim. Even though in the end, they're the same standard, I had to bring both of them down to tell you that it applies in both cases. That's the mum. And the mum, again, is a begima. It's a catch. And a catch is that the nail gets caught when you run along that, and that's the definition of a mum. Meitave, kama begimat mizbeach. What is considered to be a nick in the mizbeach, or something that would ruin the mizbeach? Bishimon ben Yochai omer tefach. It's much bigger than a nick of a catching of a fingernail. Belazer ben Yaakov Omer Kizayit. It has to be the size of a Kizayit. Both of these far exceed what we would call a Pigima, where your Tziporin gets caught in it. Lokasha, Habasida, Habaavno. That's not a problem. We can resolve that. It depends where the nick or where the damage is. The damage is in the stone. There we have a much higher standard. The Torah says, avanim shleimot. They must be shaleim legamre. That means that if you even have the smallest nick where your nail gets caught in it, they're no longer avanim shleimot, and they can't be used. It's posel the mizbeach, or you'd have to replace that part of the mizbeach. On the other hand, if it's the sid, it's the plaster that's going around, there it's just to square out the mizbeach, not to actually be, quote-unquote, smooth. It's just to make it into the shape that you need. There you need something more significant to be missing for it to lose its shape as a square or whatever the needs of the size of the mizbeach are. And there would be a tefach or a kezayit. Over here, the Baal HaTosafot about discuss the Gemara and Avodah Zarah with regards to the Chashmonaim. When they came back and found the mizbeach in ruins, over there they were trying to decide what to do with it. So over there they said, well, we can't break the stones in order to get rid of the tumah, because then they would need to be avanim shleimot. We can't cut the stones because you have lotanif aleim barzel. So what we can only do is put them into geniza and restart again with the mizbeach. Now Tosafot over here says, I don't understand. It says, v'heyuch banu mizbeach, danayim su avanim shlo b'lo pigima. Where are we ever going to find stones that have no nicks in them, no little catches in them? V'im yachliku b'barzel, yika yisura. The lotanif aleim barzel. If you cut it with metal, that's not going to work. Don't say that it was done by the worm that used to do cutting. Because if you do it the shamir, they would not be smooth. And his proof is from the Chashmonaim. The Chashmonaim don't use the shamir. That would have been an option available to them. And they don't use it. Shows you it would not have made a smooth cut. This is Tosafot the Shita Dal, that the shamir was still there in Bayit Sheni and was available to them, and yet they didn't use it. He says that proves that the cut of the shamir is not a smooth cut. It's a cut that has catches in it. If that's the case, then how are we ever going to get stones that are so smooth? The Tosafot says, Yesh lamar, depeir kezim ukoman, masha shbanu otam ba'avanim tanot chalukot, shelo ayu behem shum kima, kagon chalukei avanim shel nacha. They used to use the riverbed stones that were smoothed out by the water. So they're naturally smoothed out by the water, and there they're extremely smooth and have no catches on them. So they were using smaller types of stones to build it, and that's what the Gemara says. They used to put the stones in, and then they filled it with the sid in order to square it out and to give it the shape, because obviously the stones aren't going to give you that. Although Tosafot says, then it's a little hard to understand when the Gemara says that they used to use Evin Shleimah Masa, that they used very large stones to build the Mizbeach and the Mikdash, because how did they ever get stones were that large that were smooth? I understand when you're talking about smaller pebbles or stones that are smaller from the riverbeds, but they're not going to be even masa that you're putting in there, so you leave that as a tzarachion. Okay, we're going to stop over here, four lines down on the top of Yudchet Amud Aleph.